you want to travel the world and make a documentary about the Buddha? And she was like, are you serious? Like, don't do joke with me like that. And I was like, no, I'm serious. So we said, okay, let's go and check, you know, the sacred places and on the way, see what we find and let the journey make their own decisions. We find out that the Buddha does different practice for different people. And there's like 40,000 different discourses. They kind of all claim that they have the, you know, the original path and the, you know, the pure teaching of the Buddha. That's a classic. Yeah, definitely my practice changed a lot. Now my practice really depends on how my mind is.
Many longtime listeners know that our podcast platform was initially focused on interviews about the many spiritual paths that Myanmar offers meditators and monastics. But when the coup hit, we couldn't in good conscience continue to tell those stories with so many monastic sites on fire or occupied by soldiers and the Burmese people living under the military's reign of terror. So we expanded our mission to cover a wider range of post-coup Myanmar stories. Still, some guests have a unique insight into the intersection of the spiritual with the worldly, allowing a deeper understanding of both planes. Today's guest fits squarely in that category, as you will soon hear. I'm so pleased to be joined today by Diego Brito. Along with Camila Arias, he led a monumental multi-year media project, creating a documentary that spanned many countries and interviewed leading scholars, monks, and meditation teachers. The film's mission was to explore the legacy of the Buddha and the relevance of his teachings in the 21st century. In his own words, Diego has described the work as follows, quote, starting in India and its neighboring countries, Diego and Camila follow the footsteps of the historical Buddha, searching for teachers who have embodied his teachings in these times. The journey takes an unexpected turn when Diego will have to confront his own ghosts in a meditation retreat and will have to put everything he has learned into practice, end quote. I'm really excited to get into the conversation that follows, and I also want to highlight to listeners that there is quite an unusual aspect of this talk. So while we will be releasing this episode as we normally do with any other episode of Insight Myanmar podcast on our feed, Diego actually has another underlying purpose for our conversation. As the film has not yet been released, at the time of our interview at least, sections of this talk will be added to the narration of the film itself. So what you're hearing is kind of an art in the moment with a free-flowing discussion forming the basis of the very film that we're going to be reviewing. In any case, let's get right to it. So Diego, it's great to have you on here. We've spent the better part of a year planning for this talk, and I'm so glad it's finally happening.
Yeah, thank you, Joa.
Right, so first, let's get into a little more about your background. I know you're from Chile. Which part of the country are you from?
I'm from Santiago, which is the capital, but I grew up more like in the mountain side, so since I was a child, I was, you know, normally walk all over the mountains and kind of my only connection to the world because, you know, Chile is like pretty far away from everything. was through documentaries. That was my connection to Europe, to Asia, to the world, basically, since I was pretty young.
Right. So you grew up watching documentaries and accessing the world that way, and then you made your own. I understand Chile is also quite a Christian country. What was the religious backdrop of your own family?
Yeah, pretty much Christian. My school, my family, my family still are very, very strict Christian, but very open-minded. So they really support me and, you know, they really ask me a lot of questions about my point of view of life and religious and spirituality, but they don't like force me to believe what they believe. So that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so you had mentioned that you grew up between the mountains and the documentaries. And soon after that, you had the travel bug pretty early on. And I'm wondering, what shape did your early travels take? And why was it important for you to see beyond your community and home country?
Well, like watching documentaries, I kind of realized that even though from generation, we humans try to like share with other generations, like our mistakes and our achievement, but somehow we keep following the same mistakes again and again. So I was wondering, if I travel the world and I get to know all these different cultures, maybe I will find not maybe a solution, but the why. I was really wondering about why we fall in this trap, like we fall in all these like patterns, behaviors that are really, I don't know, lead us into suffering somehow.
Right. So that was part of your early reason for traveling, even before you got into meditation. Where did you actually go when you first started your travels?
So my first plan was just to travel around South America. I was with no money. So I just, with my little saving, I bought a camera. And I don't know, I wanted to travel with my camera, even though I'm not a filmmaker. I mean, I didn't study that. I studied architecture. But I love cameras and taking pictures. So I decided, okay, I will travel with my camera and maybe, you know, make some interviews and that maybe I will do something with that. But a few weeks before I was ready to travel to Argentina, I lost my camera in a square. So I was with no camera and no money 2 weeks before my journey start. And then the same day, just before I lost my camera, somebody told me about Australia and the working holiday journey, you know, that you can go and work there. So After I lost my camera, I checked my account, my bill account, and I realized I have exactly the same amount of money that you need to apply for the visa in Australia. So I did it. I applied and I went there with no money and started working there and it was pretty cool because I could buy a better camera and more equipment and save a lot of money and then just keep traveling around, you know, Southeast Asia and Europe. And yeah, at the end, I think it was more than 20 countries or 22 countries, something like that.
Oh, wow. That's quite a bit of travel for someone who hadn't really left your home region before. And so you went to all these places, you had a circuitous route to get to Australia, and then from there went on to Southeast Asia and Europe. But 20 countries, as you say, but you mentioned that part of your reason for wanting to travel was you were looking for answers. You wrote about that separately from our interview. And yet when you came back home to Chile, you said that you came with more questions than answers than when you even left. So what happened on that trip?
So yeah, I was very curious about spirituality and religion. So I was like taking all the courses that I found on the way. So I was, in Australia, one weekend, I did a chakra healing seminary. And then, you know, after 4 days, I was, you know, reading chakras and making healing. And then next few weeks, I was doing the Reiki course and I was, you know, level one or level two, and I was doing Reiki. And like this, I was just trying everything. I was trying so many different meditation, from yogis to, you know, all different cultures. I did retreat in Central America, in Guatemala, and I learned, you know, Kabbalah and astral journeys and so many different things. And somehow, none of all this technique or meditations really give me the answer that I was looking for. I was like really, really looking for a source, you know, something very, very deep. And somehow all these practices, for me, was very fun. I love it, but it was not like deep enough from what I was looking for. I don't know. That's my perception. Maybe for others it's deep enough, but for me it was didn't fulfill my search.
Right. So after all that travel, you came back to your home country, and it was there that you ended up going to a local Vipassana center in the tradition of Essen Goenka, and you took a 10-day silent retreat. So did this experience back home finally start to give you some of those answers you'd been searching for?
Yes. While I was traveling, I was hearing this retreat of Goenka, 10 days retreat, and I didn't felt ready at that point. I hear about it like 10 times, you know, again and again. It was like so many times people talking about that. And I was like, 10 days silence, you know, I'm very good on talking and moving. And so I was not feeling really ready for that. But after coming back home and hear that you can do that retreat very close to my parents' house, I said, okay, I think I'm ready. You know, I tried so many different things and now I'm back here. Let's try it. And yeah, it was pretty special because you are there 10 days, no cell phone, no books, no writing, no drawing. I'm like drawing all the time, so no pencil for me. And you're just there for 10 hours a day with your eyes closed most of the time. And every night you hear like a discourse about the teaching of the Buddha. And yeah, definitely there's something click inside me. It's like I have this puzzle with all these, you know, pieces flying in the air. And then suddenly, like they start to, you know, yeah, it was something very, very special for me. Definitely.
Right. So after all this travel, just right around the corner from your parents' house, you found a practice that spoke to you. And how did this impact your life going forward after that course?
Yeah. After that course, I really wanted to get deep in that. And for me, that's something very strange. You know, I'm not really good on to, you know, get deep in things. I'm always moving from one thing to another. I play tennis and then I like skiing and then I like other things. And the same with spirituality. I was just all my life, just jumping from one thing to other. And suddenly I was very curious to get deep on this one. So I was meditating 2 hours a day for many years, I think 4 years, every day. Like even when I went to parties and I come back at 4 a.m., I'll sit there and meditate for 1 hour, like very, very strict, like never before. And doing retreats every, I don't know, 4 months again, and serving, you know, like helping in the kitchen and stuff. So yeah, I really took it very seriously for many years. Yeah.
Okay, so let's get right into this great documentary you've been working on. There are many people that are deeply impacted by meditation. They're inspired by the Buddhist teachings, but you've gone above and beyond this to actually engage in study and art to better understand as well as disseminate this. How did the idea come on to take a project on of this nature?
Well, you know, as I said before, my way to connect to the world is it's been through documentaries. So once I start getting more deep into meditation, I really want to know more about the theory and the teaching of the Buddha. And normally I've been very lazy with books. So I always start first with documentaries. So I was searching for a documentary about the teachings of the Buddha. And I look everywhere and I couldn't really find one that explained about the teachings. You find some, you know, BBC, very historical and very boring. And then there's a few ones that they're more like well done, but they talk more about the life of the Buddha and where did they take the information? You know, they don't really get into the source of what they're saying. So I was like, and then I was meditating and the idea came in my mind, maybe you should do a documentary about the teaching of the Buddha. And I was like, no. I was like, I'm an architect from Chile. Nothing related with a filmmaker who make a documentary for me, the most amazing guy in the history. So yeah, my first impression was no, definitely not. But then like every single meditation, this idea was coming in my mind for, I don't know, many months. So at one point I realized like I have to do something, otherwise I will not able to meditate anymore. So I said, okay, let's make a deal. I will do something. I will just travel, learn. And maybe after, with all the information, I can make a PowerPoint and show it to my family. So that was the first idea, to just calm my mind and come back to meditation.
Right. So this is now a massive undertaking that you're getting into. And I think I can sympathize to some extent because, like you, I had this seed of interest in creating a meditator's guidebook to Burma. It was growing in my own mind. And yet when I finally took the steps to get the project off the ground, it was something that was kind of overwhelming about the journey in front of me. So in your case, how did you and Camila begin the preliminary work?
Well, yeah, exactly. My first idea was, I have to do this with somebody, you know? This is just definitely, even though a PowerPoint for my family, it was too big to do it to myself. So I was thinking, like, who will want to travel with me around the world with no money? Just a little saving I was, you know, from working as an architect. And, you know, spend all that time. And I was thinking, and then suddenly, Camila, yeah, Camila is a very strong meditator. She loved traveling and she studied filmmaking. So yeah, it was pretty obvious. And she was in India at that time. So I called her and I said, hey, Camila, you want to travel the world and make a documentary about the Buddha? And she was like, are you serious? Like, don't do joke with me like that. And I was like, no, I'm serious. And she's like, okay, let's do it. And yeah, that was the beginning, you know?
Right. So that's quite a bit that you have to take on. And what challenges did you face along the journey of trying to create this documentary? What happened that surprised you that you had to find a way to respond to and continue the project?
Yeah, our first plan was going to India because, you know, we knew Buddha born there and spent all their life there. So we said, okay, let's go and check, you know, the sacred places and on the way see what we find and let the journey make their own decisions, something like that. And we were very lucky that since we arrived, well, the first challenge we have is like, how are we going to move with all our film equipment? You know, there's pretty heavy and steady cams and three cameras. We have a drone. And that time it was pretty big. Now they're very small. And finally, we choose the least recommended option, that is buying a car in India, you know? So we bought a car as foreigners, and finally, we traveled, I think, more than 10,000 kilometers driving in India. And so, yeah, that was pretty, pretty amazing. Like, now I felt like a really professional driver after that.
Yeah, I can imagine, personally speaking, of the 30 or so countries I've been to, the traffic in India is definitely in a class of its own. Even riding in a car, let alone crossing a street, is an experience enough. And yet you guys decided to purchase a car and drive yourself. So how was that?
It was crazy. Like in Chile, I never crashed, never in all my life. In India, the first week, I crashed 4 times.
Wow.
Yeah. So you're driving and then motorbikes start to just get in your way. So I was like trying to stop and crash a motorbike. The motorbike crashed a lady. The lady fell in the ground. I said like, oh man, I will get deported. And then people start to scream and coming to me like trying to hit me. But then when they realized I was a foreigner, everybody starts smiling and say like, hey. So it was pretty funny. Mm. Yeah. And we were very lucky because the first week we get there, we met Daniel Stewart that you know pretty well, just by chance. And so Dan is a scholar and also a practitioner in Buddhism. So he was a key part of the documentary because he kind of gave us like, he kind of opened our eyes in the whole spectrum of Buddhism. So it was from the very beginning, it was much easier for us to know more or less the context of how did Buddhism get here, you know, after 2,500 years. And it was easy to ask for, to know where to go next.
Mm, yeah, that's great. That's great. You were able to connect with him. So you met him in India originally?
Yeah. We met him in India. We've been with him a few times. The second time it was in US when we were doing another interview, but the first time was in India, as I said, just the first week I arrived there. So yeah, it was very important in our process.
Mm, right. Yeah, that's great. He and I actually met back in 2003 and we were on a Satipatthana course in Thailand. So he was just the pilgrimage that S.N. Goenka was leading throughout Burma had just finished. And he and a group of others had come to Thailand to sit Satipatthana. I had come down from Japan where I'd been living for 3.5 years to also set that same course. And my first trip to Burma was just about a week after that. And Dan actually gave me my very first Lungji. He had had an extra Lungji that he had bought when he was over there. So I think I might still have it to this day. So I
really?
Always recall that I might. I keep things that have special meaning. So nice. Yeah, that was very first Lungji I ever had a week before I went to Burma. So let's talk about the places that you actually visited for the film. Where did you end up going and how did you select that itinerary?
So yeah, for us was naturally to first go to the sacred places like the pilgrimage that normally people go. So we really want to see with our own eyes. And actually in some suttas, the Buddha said that it was very important from someone who wants to pay respect to the Buddha to visit that place. So it was kind of important for us. And we went to all the sacred places, you know, from Lumbini, we started there. And actually it was pretty funny because we took the car to the border and we said to the guards, you know, in the border, can we park the car here? And then we just keep going, walking and take a bus maybe in Nepal, you know, because you have to cross the country. And they said, but why you don't go with your car? And I said, no, it's like, I bought this car to a friend that he bought it to an Indian and I don't have even the paper. I have just a photocopy from the last owner. And he looked at the photocopy. It was in really bad condition. And he said, no, that's okay. You can go. So we just keep driving into Nepal with no problems. You know how it is there.
Yeah.
And like this, yeah, we have many adventures driving. We filmed with our drone and then we realized it was illegal and they want to deport us and things like that. But the thing is, after traveling around all these sacred places, it was very inspiring and we met a lot of very nice people there, but we felt like we want to know more about the practice, you know, or even though more about the theory. And talking with Daniel, he said to us that in Sri Lanka there was a place where the Buddha's teaching were supposed to written down for first time. So we were very curious about that. So yeah, after traveling around India, we really wanted to know more about these suttas that they written down into palm tree, I think, or banana leaves, yeah. So we crossed to Sri Lanka and we went to visit that. So yeah, that was like the first place outside India we went.
Right. And related to this, you also spoke to a wide number of people. So what factors went into the list that you crafted? What kinds of qualities were you looking for in those interviews?
So yeah, once we get to Sri Lanka, we really wanted to learn from our own. So we hear about a library that have like so many different books. And so we start to, you know, like study, you know, just me and Camila and reading, but there were like more than 20,000 publications in Sri Lanka in the, I forgot the name of the library, but it was pretty, pretty big. And we realized it was impossible for us to to grasp all that information. So we talk about it and we realized that maybe it was a better idea to go and interview people, an expert of the field, that they've been studying all these, you know, texts for decades. And try to interview experts from different traditions. So we will have like trying to find like a common view, you know, something in between all these different traditions. There are so many traditions and trying to find like kind of a core of the teachings. Something we didn't want to go really deep into the details. We want to grasp like the general idea, but to know that they're like kind of original from the Buddha. So that was our strategy to go and interview this expert from different traditions and see what they can say about the teaching of the Buddha and see how they connect in between each other.
Right. And these guests that you interview, they're all quite big names in their own right. Was it difficult for you to secure interviews with all these people?
It was pretty funny, you know, because the more respect we have from one of the interviewers, it was easier to grasp there, you know, to get to there. So normally Camila make the work to send them mails and talk about the project. But the one that we most wanted to interview, they were agreeing immediately. And the one that we were not very, you know, sure about it, they were like, really like, nah, I'm not sure, maybe not. So yeah, it's like Yeah, it was pretty funny how the ones that we really most wanted, it was like, like a highway.
Right. So the energy returned from what you were sending out. And among these many hours of interviews that you're conducting with this wide range of people, were there certain moments or things that people said or exchanges that really stood out that you think of now, of exchanges that you had with someone that really were profound to you or shifted something in you?
I would say the first things that really impressed me was that also Big Ubodi and Analayo, both really expert on the, you know, on the theory and the like kind of archaeologist part, like the reading of the text, they're both like they explain us that all these different traditions come out from maybe, I don't know, they separate like after 100 years after the Buddha died. And they really spread around the world very far away. And they don't have like, you know, in that time, they didn't have like the connection that we have now. So they really separate from each other for many, many, many years. And now you can connect that and you can overlap all the different teachings that they carry on with all these years. And you can compare them. And it's amazing how many of these discourses are like very, very, very similar, although they've been separate from each other for like 2,500 years. And especially one discovery they made in Pakistan. I don't know if you hear about the Gandhari text they found, that they said they are like from 100 or 200 years after the Buddha, and they're like intact. You know, they make carbon 15, 14, I don't know. And they said that there's one sutta named the Rhinoceros Sutta, I think. And they compared that sutta, that discourse, with the discourses of the Chinese version, the Pali version, the Tibetan version, and they overlap perfectly. So that was the first thing that really, really caught my attention, because, wow, like, it's hard to find something like that, like in Christianity, for example. Very, very hard. So yeah, that was very impressed and gave me a lot of faith also in the teachings.
Yeah, that's great. And when you were deciding who you wanted to talk to and then what you wanted to ask them, what kinds of information were you especially interested to learn, and what did you want to impart to your viewers?
Yeah, and the part that me and Camila were studying, we find out that in many different books, there's like this element of morality and concentration and insight or wisdom. So these like three major topics was very important for us, because we find out that they're very important in all the different traditions. So we start asking about that main topics and see how they explain it and see how they understand it. And it was very interesting how a Tibetan nun start to overlap with a Theravada monk, and, you know, talking about the same thing but in different angle. And then while I was editing the documentary, I started to connect the different conversation and how it was like a conversation they will have with each other, and it was beautiful. Yeah. So we focus in these major three topics: morality, concentration, and wisdom, and also metta, that is like compassion. And so that was like the kind of the four major elements of the interviews.
Right. So concerning all these people that you're speaking to, it sounds like there was definitely a common ground of these four basic elements. Did you find other connections or similarities throughout the talks?
Yeah. I mean, it was very interesting, because once they get into the details of how they explain this concept, they explain in a different way, but once you look at from outside, you can see that they're talking about the same thing but with different angles. So it was, for me personally, I was like grasping concepts, you know, from different views, and it was like my mind was getting more and more information about how to look something from different ways. So it was not that they are saying the same thing in the same way. They're saying the same thing in completely different ways sometimes. And that was very interesting for us to understand Buddhism from a complete different angles and see the you know, the whole picture of it. And yeah, it was pretty intense also to change from a preconception of Buddhism and then start to open your mind to something completely different. You know, it changed a lot. Like, what is Buddhism for me now is completely different from what it was 4 years ago.
Right, I can imagine. So how did that change? How, if Buddhism is different for you now than it was before, what shifted?
Yeah, actually something very important was about the practice. So after we did the interviews, we felt like we wanted to learn more about the specific practices that different traditions they have. And so even though we were practicing every day and doing retreats, we really want to know if we can find like a living master. You know, we've been hearing about enlightenment all this time, like reading about enlightenment. And so we try to find out if there's still living enlightened master in the world. And so the first place we went after the interviews was actually Myanmar, where we met you, because we hear about Webu Sayadaw, that he was supposed to be an enlightened master. So we went there and we met one of the disciples, Umandala, and he was very kind to let us stay there and explain us how it was a place where a living, you know, enlightened being was teaching to so many different people. And we were like so excited about it, and we were meditating there for many days. And yeah, it was very, very interesting. And like asking here and there, we hear that there actually in Thailand, there were teachers that they're supposed to be enlightened right now, and they are teaching right now. So that was like the next step for us was, okay, let's take a look and let's see from our own eyes who are these people. So yeah, that was something very big and very important also in the documentary.
Right. So you went in Thailand after you were in Myanmar, and who were you able to meet in Thailand? What did you do during your stay there?
Well, we hear about, well, there's supposed to be many Thai teachers that they're like well known to be enlightened. But there were two that were very open. They are very open to Western. That's Ajahn Suchart and Ajahn Anand. And they actually live very close. Even though they're like kind of from different teachers, they live very close together. So it was pretty obvious that we have to go that way. And so we spend some time with both. We stay there. We meditate with them. We get to know them pretty well. And yeah, it was a really mind-blowing experience. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you find the practices and monastic traditions different between Thailand and Burma? Because they're both practicing Theravada Buddhism, and yet they're completely different cultures. So when you were staying in remote Thai monasteries, actually I should say remote Thai meditative monasteries, and then remote meditative Burmese monasteries. So what distinction did you find between them?
Yeah, they have few differences, but in generally, like, because in both places we were in, you know, outside the city. So I find out that when they are like kind of forest monk, the way they live is not too different. But once you get into the city, they change a lot. And that's applied for both, for Thailand and Myanmar. So when you met monks on the city in Myanmar or in Thailand, they're more relaxed with the rules, and yeah, it's pretty, they're more like, I don't know, I would say they put more focus in other things. Sometimes they get more into the theory and the parijati part, that is more studying, and they get more relaxed about the meditation and also the rules. But yeah, I find out that in the forest, they're very serious about meditation. And I would say maybe the main difference is that they don't, in Thailand, they don't put much like attention in the deep theory. I think in Myanmar, they're more serious about learning, you know, like all the suttas and by memory or by heart, they said. In Thailand, they were more like just practice, you know. If you want to follow your breath, that's your object, just keep with that. And that was something that really impressed me, that they like kind of get the knowledge from inside. And once you talk with them, especially with Ajahn Suchart and Ajahn Anand, you can ask them anything anything about your girlfriend, about money, about, there's no limit. You know, they are there and they're, you know, they just listen to you. And every time they answer you, you're like, whoa, that's so obvious. How I didn't see that, you know? So yeah, I can't say they are enlightened because, you know, I'm not able to distinct that, but I can say they're very, very special beings. Like, I get the feeling that they are normal people and we are so messed up and such crazy people. I feel that way. I feel like, wow, I'm such a crazy guy, because that's normality, you know? You see him sitting there, no rush, with such a wisdom. And yeah, it was pretty, pretty amazing experience to be with them.
Right, right. And I would probably guess that the experiences you had were more reflective of like the Thai forest tradition, and that standard Thai Buddhism probably falls under somewhat of a different category in terms of its more of its standardization and organization and such. I did want to go back to some of the teachers that you were talking to, that you interviewed, and we talked a bit about their similarities and what they had in common. I guess what I'm curious about is, one wouldn't necessarily expect that all these different teachers and scholars, many coming from these diverse traditions, would be in full agreement about the life and teachings of the Buddha. So looking at their differences and their distinctions, what did you encounter in terms of what was different between their outlooks?
Yeah, I found a few things that really impressed me, like some things about morality. Like you find out that some monks, for example, use money in some countries, like in Tibet, for example. They are not so strict with that. And for example, in Thailand, they were very, very strict with that. Like in the forest tradition, you don't see any monk carrying money at all. And sometimes you see that, for example, in Theravada, in Myanmar. So it was things that maybe it's not too much about tradition, but it depends really on the places. And other things about, for example, it was the approach to vegetarianism. Like, I was very impressed that a lot of these Buddhist countries, they eat a lot of meat and they give meat to the monks. And I understand monks will receive it because they're monks, but I was impressed how, like in Thailand or Myanmar, they eat a lot of meat and they give the monks meat. And you ask them, why you do it? And they say, no, because I didn't kill him or kill it. So that really impressed me. Like, and for example, Western monks, they're really strict with that. And Western lay people are very strict with that, both. So yeah, it seems like Buddhists that come from Western background, they took very serious like things like money and not killing people. Something like that really impressed me.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And in talking to them, were there any personal doubts that you found that you were able to clarify through these conversations?
Yeah, well, with the Jansu chart, actually, I was, you know, talking about my practice, and because I was doing Vipassana for so many years. And I was struggling with Vipassana a lot. It was very hard for me. Like, I was kind of compare myself to my friends that, you know, Camila and all my other friends that now they're all teachers of meditation. Some are monks, and they were like doing, you know, like 60-day retreat with no problems, and or being in monastery for many months. And I was struggling a lot with that. And I asked Ajahn Suchart, and he said, oh, don't go to Vipassana, you know, you just stay with Anapana and you need more mindfulness, you know, increase that mindfulness, don't get into Vipassana. And I kind of hear him, but somehow at that point, my craving for enlightenment was so strong that like his recommendation was not able for me in that moment to grasp it. I grasped it later on. So after being with him, I went to do a 20 days retreat, a Vipassana retreat in India. And the documentary was almost done. We kind of filmed everything we needed. So I wanted to just get more into the meditation. So I went to this retreat and I was like working very, very serious. I was on my cell just working and working for the jhanas and working for enlightenment. I was like kind of very focused, but maybe not very equanimous. Actually, not equanimous at all. And somehow I get to a point where I was seeing a lot of visions, you know, like demons, and kind of, I think maybe it was like past life, but not from the heaven, you know, it was like kind of a past life stories from the hell. So I really freak out. And after a few hours about that experience, I get into a panic attack, very, very strong. And I start to have more and more panic attacks during the course. Every 5 minutes I have one. And so I was talking with the teacher about it. And he was trying to guide me. And after a few days, I thought that I was going crazy. So the teacher said, okay, you need to calm down. And he put me with the gardener and start, you know, taking care of the plants during the course, inside the course, you know, area. So I was doing the course, but instead of meditating myself, my meditation practice was, you know, planting and making holes and things like that. And that helped me a lot. And then I realized, and I remember Ajahn Suchard, and I was like, whoa, yeah, I was going to Vipassana without mindfulness. So then I realized that, yeah, meditation without a proper guidance and without taking very serious the guidance of your teacher can be very, very dangerous.
Right. So do you think that panic attack was in any way affected by or informed by all this work you were doing to the documentary, that there was all this information you were gathering that somehow was contributing to a way that you approached meditation different on that course? Or do you think that these two things were not related so much?
Yeah, it took me a while to understand why this happened to me. And I think there's like a combination of many, many factors. Like normally panic attack, now I'm kind of an expert in panic attacks, you know, it was so strong that I kind of study a lot and I work out how to come out from it without medication. So I can say that one big part is you have like a, you are on your mind a lot. And so you're like kind of not grounded at all. So that's very common in panic attack, is like you're really on your mind and you're thinking too much. I was traveling, I was with no really plans for my life more than maybe becoming a monk. So I was like really on the air, you know? So I was like flying in the air, but at the same time with no mindfulness. So when you don't have mindfulness and you get to a very deep place, that means you don't have the way to control your mind and keep with your object. So once I get very deep and I get into these strong visions, my mind just went everywhere and I couldn't control. And that's when all this panic attack, that is something very physically, came out. But at the same time, it's something very spiritual, because you kind of get in a place where you are in between your physical body and your astral body. So even though it's something that medicine recognizes as something very physically, once you experience it, it's very spiritual, because you don't feel here. Actually, that's one of the things you recognize when you are in a panic attack, is you don't feel reality. You are like in between. So it was a very strong experience. And I think, yeah, it was a combination of many factors, and mainly not developing mindfulness. That is my major conclusion, because that may happen to many people. You know, have panic attacks is not something very rare, actually happened to 1/3 of the population. So it's something common, especially in this generation that we are so much in the mind. So it's like a disequilibrium, you know, of the mind. So yeah, I will say mindfulness was something very important. And I think Ajahn Suchard could see that in me briefly and said to me, but yeah, I couldn't grasp it at that time.
Right. Have you had any experiences with panic attacks after that?
Well, it took me like 2 years to come out from that panic attack experience, you know, because I was having it every 5 minutes on the course. But after the course, it was maybe 3 a day. And then...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then that...
Oh, that's serious.
Yeah. And I decided to came back to Chile to, you know, to stay with my family and you know, like find a way to come out of it. And like what helped me a lot was work with plants. Like I was doing a veggie garden and making sport. And the hard part for me was that I couldn't meditate for like few months, I was not able to sit and meditate because I sit and close my eyes and boom, I get into panic attack. And so, yeah, I started talking with teachers and yeah, they recommend me to just stop meditating. And so that was very, very hard for me because I was so, you know, on the way to becoming a monk. And suddenly I was, you know, being a gardener and playing tennis. Mm. So yeah, it was,
wow.
Yeah, it was very hard for me, but yeah, I understand that actually, I was going to therapy and the therapist said to me, but if the goal of, you know, Buddhism is to detach, you're supposed now to detach to your ideas of becoming a monk or becoming enlightened. And I was like, oh, yeah, maybe that's what I have to do now. Detach from my plans because they were not real, you know. My plans to becoming a monk or, you know, becoming an enlightened being was just in my mind. It was just an idea. My reality that I was on the city, you know, living with my parents, that was my reality. So, yeah, that was part of my spiritual journey in the last 2 years is to detach from that and work slowly. And now I'm able to meditate every day and I'm kind of coming back into that path, but with a completely different angle, you know, a completely different perspective of Buddhism.
Right. So you came from practicing Vipassana in the Goenka tradition. You interviewed some people within the tradition for your documentary. You also interviewed different scholars and practitioners from many different lineages and traditions. And you had one of the most impactful personal relationships with Ajahn Suchat of the Thai forest tradition, who gave you advice that sounds like it's still resonating to this day. So having that experience of talking to different people from different backgrounds, and your practice has been and sounds like continues to be within the Vipassana organization as taught by SM Goenka, has it been challenging to integrate these different kinds of advice and feedbacks coming? Or on the contrary, has it been kind of helpful to be able to have different approaches and different ways to understand what the practice is?
Yeah, it's been kind of challenging to come back from I was, you know, practicing before my journey. So in here, the Goenka community is very strong. And there's no other community than that in terms of Theravada Buddhism. And I, after like meeting all these different monks, I'm still resonating myself more with Theravada Buddhism. And I don't think Theravada is better than the other ones. It's just the one that I feel more connected with. You know, I feel they're all equally valid. But so as there's no other tradition in South America or especially in Chile, it's common to come back to all my friends into the Goenka tradition, that they're like all very, very committed and very nice people and they're very, very good friends. But yeah, it's been challenging because now I have different views that, you know, I have with me and I can't, you know, be silent about that. I like to talk about it, you know, I love to be open about it. And sometimes it's very challenging for them also to hear that. And I can see that they're not really, you know, easy with some of the things that I said. So I'm trying to just be more quiet and see what is better for each of my friends when I'm talking about Buddhism.
Right. So I understand that being back in your home country and area, that being involved in the Vipassana tradition of SM Goenka is the only option you really have. And yet you did do all this travel where you got to experience these other ways of practice and formulating the teachings. And that now that you're back there, you can't really talk about that. Or maybe you can talk about different parts with different people. But where does that place you internally? So although you're integrated in a tradition and you're engaging externally according to circumstance and condition, what is the internal formulation with that? Where are you at with all of the learning that you've done, all the people that you've talked to, all the meditative advice that you've also learned through these experiences? So through your internal practice and understanding, and of course, I'm sure this is influenced by coming out of 2 years of panic attacks, which I had no idea that it was something that serious that you had to spend that much time trying to come out of. And that, of course, also affected your spiritual life and plans and meditative practice as well. But all of this cumulatively, your travel, your experience, the documentary, the community you're in now, the overcoming of the panic attacks, everything else, where does that leave you now as a practitioner, as not just someone who practices, but also someone who reads and thinks and interprets what different traditions and teachings were? Where does that leave you internally after all this?
Yeah, definitely my practice changed a lot. Now my practice really depends on how my mind is. So what I'm doing is I'm meditating and suddenly I felt my mind is getting into passion, for example. And then I remember talking with someone, said, oh, the medicine for passion is to think about the disgusting part of your body. And I said, ah, okay, that's the medicine for that. And then when that is done, I realized, oh, now I come back to my breath. So the breath is kind of still my major object. But now when my mind is onto something else, before I was just fighting, against the mind. Now I have a lot of new tools to give the medicine to that problem and then come back to my breath. And kind of all these different practices and techniques from different teachers allowed me to now have a stronger equipment of tools to fight the defilements. So that's a big change in my personal practice now. And I try to be more easygoing with myself also. That's something very different from before. So sometimes I realize that none of all these other tools works and so on. Maybe I just need to just go and walk, and stop meditating. So yeah, I think now I have more tools, but at the same time, I'm more relaxed with the practice.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So all the travels and experience and talking to different people that gave you this wider sense of what you can do in this situation or that one, whereas before you were coming from, it sounds like a bit more of a structured place where you had to do the same thing every time in different kind of situations and just keep hammering at it. But this experience of traveling and talking and studying and then disseminating, actually creating something, gave you a bit more space and flexibility for looking at when different situations came up in the mind, being able to meet them in different ways and perhaps being somewhat like playful and creative and experimental as well. Whereas before, perhaps it was more formulaic. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, pretty much. And actually, I realized after all this journey and traveling and meeting all these people that I couldn't find a formula. You remember I was saying I want to find this core teaching of the Buddha, And yeah, we couldn't find any of that. We find out that the Buddha taught different practice for different people. And there's 40,000 different discourses of the Buddha to different people or group of people. But even though when there was a group of people, it is said that he was kind of appointing one in specific that he was ready to grasp and he was just direct this, because we are so different. We have such a different background. So yeah, I think the Buddha was pretty clever in to choose the exact teaching for the exact person in the right moment. So yeah, that's why now I'm not really into finding this one formula. That's happened a lot with different traditions also, they have this is the major formula that the Buddha taught, at that time. And they kind of all claim that they have the original path and the pure teaching of the Buddha. That's a classic. And yeah, I'm not sure about that anymore. I'm more into find, if the Buddha was still alive, what will be my advice? I'm looking for that, considering my personality and my background,
right?
What could be the proper teaching for me? That's kind of my search right now.
Right, right. So the Buddha was so open in terms of looking at what a person's or a community's background was. He was able to fashion this core teaching of what the path of liberation was, but deliver that with kind of fill that with different flesh it out and different accoutrements so that it was most meaningful to the type of person and community that he was talking to. And so many years later, many centuries later, as the teachings have remained alive throughout time and also have traveled to different parts of the world that they've never been present in historically, that these teachings have never gotten to at all, that there are still features or parts of them that different lineages or traditions or cultures are able to find some meaning in this giant umbrella. They're able to take one part of it and derive an entire tradition or teaching around that. And that in another place, they might look at something else and fashion something else with it. So that's really interesting that in your search for creating this documentary of looking for like a core, like a central thing, there wasn't really any there. It was just different people and traditions and practices that were drawing on different parts of it. And I suppose for some people that could be a little bit disappointing or intimidating or hard to grasp. But for you, and as for me, I should say as well, when I started down that path, and I also found in the case of Myanmar especially, that some of the core things I was holding on to really weren't so, and it allowed me to let go of those and open up. Mm-hmm. Rather than creating a loss of confidence, in some ways it created a greater confidence because it showed me the kind of playfulness and experimentation and critical thought and creativity that I could have in my own practice that I through my understanding before, I just simply didn't know that that was possible. I thought that it was more formulaic. It was more step by step. And so when things weren't really working, I didn't really have a big toolbox for being able to look at them. But when that opened up, rather than feeling like, well, what is there to grasp? What is there to really look at as this is the one thing I have to do? I didn't feel a lack of confidence or a loss of faith. It was rather like, oh, I could bring so many more parts of my being into this practice than I had known before. So I don't know if it was similar to you at that point as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Perfectly. Yeah. Yeah. I think the same way. And yeah, it's amazing how actually when you get to that point that your mind explodes and you say like, well, there's nothing to hold here. You know, where is this formula? And there's no formula here. There's no guideline. You know, there's like all these concepts that we tended to put it together in a specific order, but that's something we human do more than Buddha himself, because he didn't put together, like, that's like kind of the job after people do. They took all the different discourses and say, oh, he repeat so many times this thing, and they start to create this map.
Right.
That is like it's an amazing map. So it's like too hard to don't do it, you know, because it's a super complex and brilliant map. But he never did it. Actually, we did it. But then you find out that there's nothing really on the essence that is an essence at all. And that really go together with the teaching of the Buddha that in the third... the three characteristics of existence, the third one is not existent, not being. So it makes sense. It makes sense that there's no formula to get out of the formula. You know, if you're coming out of life itself, there shouldn't be a formula, because otherwise the Buddha will toff that formula before and he didn't. So it makes sense. For me, give me more confidence, actually.
Right. If there was one formula or one technique, as many traditions claim today, I think the Buddha would have been very clear. This is my technique. This is my formula.
Yeah.
And you don't find that.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So we were talking a bit about how you were affected by the documentary. Looking at the documentary being finished and as it starts to come out, how will the documentary affect others, do you think? What do you think the documentary is able to provide to society, to practitioners, to different traditions as it comes out and people are able to watch it?
Yeah, well, my view of the impact of the documentary now is very different from what I thought it will be at the beginning, because as I said before, I thought that will be like kind of a recollection of the different traditions, trying to find a common element to say, okay, these are the essence of Buddhism or the teachings of the Buddha. And now I think the documentary is swift in more like a motivation tool, you know, to say, okay, maybe I should make that journey myself and see what is Buddhism for me. You know, I think that could be something very, very unique of this documentary. And I hope it will take that kind of way, is make people really want to explore and to find out what they will find out with his own journey. And we will try to, you know, share with them all that we find out, but there's definitely more there, and maybe they will share with us a lot of other things. So yeah, we're really excited about what's going to happen with this documentary. We have no idea.
Yeah, right. I think that once the documentary comes out and people start to watch it, that'll just be wonderful. And of course, we're talking here before the documentary is aired. Probably part of this conversation will actually be in the documentary. So it's a bit of an ironic experience with that. And people will be listening to this after it's already come out and they've been able to watch it. And I'm really excited to see what people think of it when it's out in public. It's been your kind of baby for so long of thinking about it, working on it, going through different stages. So I'm sure that once it comes out for you, it'll be a real sense of personal fulfillment and satisfaction that you've completed what you set out to do. And it's just been really great to be able to talk with you about it on here and learn about the process of doing it. And hopefully this conversation will also alert more people about the work that's already out. They'll be able to check it out and to see it themselves. So thank you so much for being able to take the time to join us and to talk about that in detail. And you spent so many years working on this. You looked at so many parts of it. Was there anything else about the work or about the process or the completed version that you want to touch upon before we leave?
I think we already talk a lot. So I maybe think that will be interesting to finish this interview with 1 minute of meditation so we can apply what we've been talking about. So yeah, I would say let's close our eyes for 1 minute and just observe our breath. Yeah, that's it, bro. We made it.
Since the coup, Better Burma has provided consistent humanitarian aid to vulnerable communities across Myanmar. Over time, however, we have also come to realize that another consequence of the coup is a severely collapsed economy. Trade and tourism have almost entirely evaporated, and local artisan communities suddenly found every opportunity of continuing livelihood closed off to them. To help support those artisan communities, Better Burma now brings item direct from their workshop into your home. These lovely pieces from a far corner of the world will not only light up your room or make a lovely gift for a loved one, but they'll also help dozens of artisans create sustainable businesses and livelihoods. Part of each purchase will also go towards our ongoing nonprofit mission. To see these beautiful crafts, visit alokacrafts.com. That's Aloka, A-L-O-K-A, Crafts, C-R-A-F-T-S, one word, alokacrafts.com. Of course, as is your preference, you can also consider making a donation through our normal channels. If you would like to join in our mission to support those in Myanmar who are being impacted by the military coup, we welcome your contribution in any form, currency, or transfer method. Your donation will go on to support a wide range of humanitarian and media missions, aiding those local communities who need it most. Donations are directed to such causes as the Civil Disobedience Movement, CDM, Families of Deceased Victims, Internally Displaced Person, IDP Camps, Food for Impoverished Communities, Military Defection Campaigns, Undercover Journalists, Refugee Camps, Monasteries and Nunneries, Education Initiatives, the purchasing of protective equipment and medical supplies, COVID relief, and more. We also make sure that our donation fund supports a diverse range of religious and ethnic groups across the country. we invite you to visit our website to learn more about past projects, as well as upcoming needs. You can give a general donation or earmark your contribution to a specific activity or project you would like to support, perhaps even something you heard about in this very episode. All of this humanitarian work is carried out by our nonprofit mission, Better Burma. Any donation you give on our Insight Myanmar website is directed towards this fund. Alternatively, you can also visit the Better Burma website, betterburma.org, and donate directly there. In either case, your donation goes to the same cause, and both websites accept credit card. You can also give via PayPal by going to paypal.me/betterburma. Additionally, we can take donations through Patreon, Venmo, GoFundMe, and Cash App. Simply search Better Burma on each platform and you'll find our account. You can also visit either website for specific links to these respective accounts or email us at info@betterburma.org. That's Better Burma, one word, spelled BETTERBURMA.org. If you would like to give it another way, please contact us. We also invite you to check out our range of handicrafts that are sourced from vulnerable artisan communities across Myanmar, available at alokacrafts.com. Any purchase will not only support these artisan communities, but also our nonprofit's wider mission. That's Aloka Crafts, spelled ALOKACRAFTS, one word, alokacrafts.com. Thank you so much for your kind consideration and support.
Yarananga yaunya na da du ya danam dari ganin da da mana we gara besaya na besaya ho ba yarananda da yarananga na yarananya da yarananga poda ba yarananga.